This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is The Morning Run, and you're here with Lynn and Noel. It is 7:19 a.m, Friday the 29th of January, and in about half an hour, we're asking, how does Malaysia compare to the rest of the world when it comes to corruption? And we'll be speaking with Transparency International Malaysia about its recently published Corruption Perceptions Index. But in the meantime, we are turning our attention to the subject of youth suicide, because in a study conducted by mental health NGO Relate Malaysia, youth suicide costs the country a staggering 350 million ringgit a year. And for every youth suicide in 2019, the Malaysian economy lost over 600,000 ringgit.
Yeah, so according to numbers released by Bukit Aman Management Director, Datuk Ramli Din, the period between March and October last year saw 266 people ending their lives by suicide. 23% of them were teenagers between 15 and 18 years old, and 53% were aged between 19 and 40 years old. So some of these really shocking figures come at the back of more calls for the government to pay attention to mental health issues.
Yes, and particularly invest in youth mental health issues, especially in suicide prevention strategies. But with a cut in the allocation for mental health in Budget 2021 from 344 million ringgit in 2020 down to 313 million ringgit, is that wise? So speaking to us this morning to expand on her Economic Cost of Youth Suicide in Malaysia paper is Dr. Chua Suk Ning, clinical psychologist and founder of Relate Malaysia. Thanks for joining us this morning, Suk Ning. Now, how did you come up with this staggering figure of nearly 350 million ringgit in terms of economic loss to the country caused by youth suicide?
Well, first, we estimated, based on the World Health Organization numbers, approximately how many youths died due to suicide in 2019. And so from the ages of 15 to 29, we estimated that 512 young people passed away from suicide. And then after that, we extrapolated based on their potential earning power. You know, how much would they have earned from the time they passed away? And we took the midpoint of 15 to 29, which is about 22 years old, to the retirement age of 65. In that amount of time, how much could they have earned? And so we calculated that, and then we brought it back to today's dollar, discounting from the inflation value. And then we also added how much the government could have made from taxes, from taxing these youth salaries.
Would you say that the figure is somewhat conservative and the real figure could actually be much higher?
I think it's extremely conservative. I mean, we know that our estimations of the number of people who passed away from suicide is already very conservative due to the lack of accurate reporting. We don't even have official suicide data anymore. And we also take, you know, like the average income of Malaysians. So you can imagine that some people could be earning much, much more. So we are really looking at on the low end of possibility. And so we took several steps to, again, make it very, very conservative by even estimating like the employment rate, you know. And so on average, the employment rate for males is 19.2%. And we increase that by 9% to say, okay, if people with mental health issues, I mean, the data shows that they are less likely to be employed. So we even took a higher unemployment rate for males and females.
So your report cites that on average, there were 2 deaths by suicide daily in 2019 and up to 20 attempted suicides, which is a very sobering statistic. Are other countries also seeing similar statistics?
The range of suicide rates does go from like 0.7% all the way up to 30%. So we're not spectacularly high. But again, I want to emphasize, we don't actually have accurate data. So we can look at Western countries and go like, look, you know, their suicide rates are higher, but we can also say, well, they have better reporting and better quality data to actually have more accurate estimates of how many people are dying by suicide. And I think the important thing is that this is such an area that hasn't received much attention. For instance, we know that, you know, last year there was a tragic case of suicide from a young girl who posted on Instagram. But since then, you know, other than this sort of cases that get a lot of media attention, after that, the attention dies down. But every day, if you think about it, every day, 2 people at least are driven to suicide out of a great deal of distress, and 10 to 20 more people on that day are trying to end their lives. So it really you know, rather than, I think, comparing between countries, it's just to look at our own society and go, look, what are we doing? You know, never mind other countries. We have to set a standard for our own people to say people are suffering and they're in distress. And how are we reaching them? How are we helping them?
Based on your research, Dr. Chua, what is driving young people to take their lives?
In Western countries, we do see that mental health problems is a big contributing factor for suicide. You know, if you're depressed, that one of the symptoms of depression is suicidal thoughts and desires. But in Asian countries, mental health issues only account for about, let's say, 60% of cases. In fact, more often than not, what triggers that kind of distress is interpersonal conflict. So, you know, people would cite actually, you know, in an argument or repeated just stressors and conflicts, and isn't not just like once off, but and that just causes so much distress in that person that they say, I can't continue living like this anymore. I see no way out. I see no reconciliation with, you know, this person. And it got so terrible that they want to end that pain at that point in time.
So I think it's clear that tackling youth suicide requires a holistic approach, given it involves the health, social, as well as economic spheres. So what kind of policies should we be looking at to address this issue?
Yeah, you know, the World Health Organization has a number of key areas which our report covers. But let me highlight a couple of things that I think all of us and all of your listeners can start doing. And one is to just understand what drives suicide and to raise awareness of it and destigmatize it. So when people reach out for help, you know, it's not about, you're so weak, you can't really deal with that. You know, it's like, how do we treat people who want help? And do we have that form? So if there is effective help being offered, that's the first thing. And the second thing is, how are we encouraging people to seek help? Now, for a long time, and I've talked about the importance of not this top-down approach where we go, you know what, you're ill or you are in distress or you have poor coping, these weak strawberry generation, that's not going to encourage anyone to seek help. And so I think that's one of the very key approach we got to take, and just humanize people's distress and understand that these are not weaker or lazier generation. You know, they're just humans and they've got a hard time and life is harder for them in many ways. And we need to offer them effective, accessible services, not quick fixes.
Should we decriminalize suicide to destigmatize?
Well, definitely the criminalizing of suicide is not helpful. I mean, the research has shown that it doesn't, you know, it stops people from seeking help again if they think they're going to be charged with a crime. I understand the intention behind it, but it's just not effective. And so we do need, I think, to make more progress in decriminalizing suicide. And Singapore did it a couple of years back, and their data shows that actually suicide rates have gone down. Now, that's just anecdotal evidence, but I think that's very good evidence for a culture that's similar to ours, that if we have the resources in place where people can seek help, and then we remove barriers to seeking help, like the, you know, criminalizing of suicide, and we increase compassion and change the attitudes and beliefs and stigma about suicidality, about mental illnesses, about help seeking, that's going to move us in the right direction of a healthier society.
So what role does the media play in perpetuating the stigmatization of suicide, and what might we be doing differently?
Media definitely plays an important role, and they actually show that when media sensationalizes suicide cases, it is associated with increased suicidal behaviors. I mean, you just need to kind of look at the newspapers nowadays and the graphics they use, the language they use to talk about suicide, even the descriptions. And so what's actually better is media blackouts about specific cases. Now, we're not saying you don't talk about suicide in general, but highlighting specific cases, going into the details, that's really not helpful, not to mention insensitive to the people who are involved. So there needs to be, you know, media needs to be on board and have the real buy-in. Like, you guys have to see that your actions are contributing to the health of the nation and affecting people's behaviors. And that needs to be done in collaboration with the Ministry of Health and, you know, all the stakeholders coming to the same table and figuring out a way that will work for you guys that's actually going to be good for the community.
Thanks so much for speaking with us this morning, Suk Ning. That was Dr. Chua Suk Ning, clinical psychologist and founder of Relate Malaysia. Now, the Bigger Picture team has had some excellent conversations with experts in the past week on destigmatizing suicide and the pressures that our youth today face, especially with the SPM in a pandemic. So check out the podcasts on the Daily Digest on the BFM app or Spotify. But right now, the 7:30 news bulletin coming up and then Apple earnings. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.